My name is Charles Harrell with the Veterans History Project. Today is December 12, 2006. I'm here near Cumberland, Maryland, interviewing Mr. Bernard Cordial about his World War II experiences. Mr. Cordial, for the record, would you state your full name?
Bernard DeSales Cordial.
What is your current address?
11900 Old Williams Road, Southeast.
Is that Cumberland?
Cumberland, C-U-M-B-E-R-L-A-N-D, Maryland, 21502.
Mr. Cordial, where were you born?
Eckert Mines, Maryland.
And when were you born?
February 14, 1927.
What branch of service were you in during World War II?
U.S. Navy.
Were you only in World War II?
Sir?
Were you in any other wars?
No, just World War II.
What ships were you attached to?
I was attached to, after boot camp and going over to the Somme, I was attached to Motor Torpedo Boat Squadron 2, Motor Torpedo Boat Squadron 3, the Calm Motor Torpedo Boats, Pacific area.
What is Calm mean?
It means complete, I would believe, complete motor torpedo squadrons. That's all in that area. Would have been in the Pacific area. Now, that's the way I gathered. And that looks like that on the discharge.
What was your highest rank before you got out of the service?
I went from apprentice seaman to hospital corpsman, seaman third, and I've come out as a pharmacist's mate third in the hospital corps.
Were you only in combat near the Solomon Islands?
In the area of Bougainville and Guadalcanal, in that area, right, Green Island, the New Hebrides, so forth, up in the Solomons, right.
When did you enlist?
Enlisted, I think we'd have to go to that.
Was that August? July 29th?
July 29th, might have been.
1943?
Right.
And when were you discharged?
February 15th, I think we'd have to look on
Was
that.
It December 15th?
December 15th, 1945.
Were you enlisted or did you get drafted?
I was enlisted.
And when were you born?
February 14, 1927. And I kind of had a little change of date on what I should have been. I moved it back to 1926.
I'd like to jump back in your earliest memories during the Great Depression. Can you recall anything that happened to you or your family during the Great Depression?
Yes. Like my father died in 1933. He was 37 years old.
What was his name?
Martin. Martin Cordial.
What happened?
Had pneumonia. They brought him out of a coal mine, number 10. He was a brakeman on the motor, and they brought him out. He was only 2 hours old when his mother died, and he had a bad heart. That's why he couldn't go in World War I. He was exempt from World War I because he had a bad heart. So this may have been a connection to him getting pneumonia so easy, and he worked so hard in a coal mine, and then he'd come out of that coal mine and into the heat or whatever. But he was building a cave for us at home and carrying these big rocks and making, and then he'd lay on the porch. So anyway, they brought him out of the coal mine on May. I'm not sure the exact date, like on a Thursday of early May, and he lived 1 week. We kept him at home. We couldn't afford to take him to the hospital or nothing. We kept him at home on an oxygen tent, and he passed away the following Thursday. And the youngest brother was 2, and it ranged from 2 to 12. My oldest brother was the oldest. He was 12. A sister, she would have been about 10 and a half, we'll say. And then Joseph, he was at that time, let's see, I was 6, and he was 4 years older, so he would have been like, he was 2 years older than that.
About 8?
Yeah. So he would have been around 10 or 12, you know, 10, I guess, wouldn't it?
Tell me about your dad, what you can remember about him.
Okay, my dad was a real, what I can remember at 6 years old, he was a baseball player, a catcher, and very fiery. He worked in the coal mine, he and his brother, and his brother Edward got cut in half with a coal car around 1917. He was 21. And he had 2 other brothers. One was Harry Cordial. He relocated to Little Rock, Arkansas. And he had a brother, Steve. My uncle Steve was in Pittsburgh. He had been in the war, and he'd got gassed in the World War I.
Did he talk about his experiences in World War I to you?
No. If he did, I wouldn't have understood too much. As I say, I was like, my dad put me in school, first grade, in that September of 32. Then he died in 33, like I say, May.
As a young boy, first grade, can you really picture your dad in your mind?
I can remember we only lived down in Eckerd. We only lived down at the bottom of a hill, and we went to the Catholic school, the nuns, up in Eckerd. It was from our house up over the hill to the coal mine where my dad worked would have been approximately 2 miles, we'll say. So we had to go up a steep hill, go to our school. But some mornings, whether he wanted to show off or not, the train, the little coal cars would come up, and he either forgot his lunch or something. So my mother, she made us take his lunch and run up real quick, and we'd stand on the bridge before they went into the coal mine, and he'd jump off and show off in front of the boys, I guess, the kids. And he was a little bull-legged, but we'd give him his lunch, and then he'd have the old motorman, he'd start it up a little fast and make it go, and my dad had to run real fast to get on it, you know. They just put on a show, sort of. But that was one of the things. And my dad, we didn't have no money. They had a big insurance, but work was slow then, and him and my mom had to cash it and pay the bills. And he didn't have nothing. So I can remember he had a cloth-covered casket, a box with cloth on it, and I can remember standing there looking at him. But before that, we'd come over that hill and he'd drink a little bit, and I can remember him singing Springtime in the Rockies. But 2 years before he died, he quit drinking altogether. He made homebrew, and he kept his beer at home, but 2 years before he died, he started building that cave and that, and he just gave up booze altogether.
What was that cave going to be?
It was going to be a place to put our potatoes and all. It was really nice. He was building her into the hill, and he had these big rocks, square rocks, and he kind of had to work by himself. He didn't get too much help in the 80s.
Did your parents own that place?
No, the coal company owned it. They owned the home. It was a comfortable home. It wasn't the world's best, but we were comfortable.
Tell me about your mom.
My mom, she was, she had been a telephone operator, And I guess they met, and she had the flu in 1918, and she almost died. Now, they got married, and they lived in the, they moved over into the Italian section of Eckerd, which was Beecher's Avenue, and they lived in with some Italian people. And then they started to raise their family.
What was her name?
Lillian. Her maiden name was Eisentrout. Lillian May Cordial, but she was Lillian May Eisentrout.
Was she Italian?
No, no. She was probably English and Irish, and my father was French. My great-grandfather migrated over in 1842 from France to America.
Your dad's dead in 1932. How did your family continue to live?
Well, it wasn't easy. My mother put us in school, and what very little relief. It was tough getting relief then. We got some canned goods and canned beef and shirts from the relief. They'd give us these relief shirts, but they was nice. And my mother washed 22 of them every Monday and put them out in the line. Had an old hand machine, she regular one of them washing machines. And she had a schedule. She would wash on Monday, and we always had nice clothes when we went to the sister school, and she'd press our shirts, and we always looked nice. And she raised chickens, and we had a garden, and all of us worked it.
Did you get to keep to live in the company town house?
We got to keep living. We lived there, but I don't know what the rent was at the time. We still had to pay the rent. But I think maybe it might have comes to mind. I heard her say one time about $10 or something. But they would maintain. They would take care of it if something happened. And you had outdoor toilets. Everybody up there had outdoor toilets. There was no sewerage or nothing.
Was there any water inside
the
house?
Yeah, there was a creek that, no water. We had a well. As a matter of fact, when I was 4 years old, or four, my oldest brother John, who was 12, he was a father after my father died, but he come over there and I fell in the well. They saw I was missing, and he had to jump down in the well. It was about 6 feet deep, I guess. But that's where we got our water from.
When you fell in the well, is that a memory you can still have?
I can remember him pulling me out. It's odd, but I can do that. I can remember having this little dog. They called him Bowser. And he lived to be about 17, and we all enjoyed him. And I'd be home from school and roaming around down around the creek and getting into things that my mother would have to come out and get me. But my other little brother, when he was born, he was in the bedroom, and my mother was having him, or had him. And of course, I was the baby up until then, and I was losing my prestige. So I got mad at my father, I can remember this, and I threw a spoon at him. We was eating breakfast, and I guess he was trying to feed us, you know, the best he could. And I threw a spoon at him, and that's the only time I can ever remember him. And he didn't spank me hard, he just let me know that I done wrong, and crawled under my mother's bed. But they were a few little things I can remember. And then I can remember Stanley's casket, and he was Catholic, and the kneeler, I can remember getting up on there and feeling his hand, and that's all I can remember about my dad. But I never had a father, you know.
After your dad passed on, did your mother do it all, or did she get remarried?
No, she raised us, never left us. Done the best she could, kept us together. Well, then my oldest brother, he got a job. We'd go and do what we could. And the train went up and down there in Eckerd. And they pump coal out of the mine. And this train would bring these big coal cars up and go over to Huffman. When you go up through the cut now, you'll see that's a little town up there before you come into 68 on 68 before you come into 36 going to Coney. That was a mine that was on fire, but every night they would bring steel cars up from Cumberland, and they coal, Big Bang coal. Big Bang coal was big lumps. And they'd fill that up, them cars up to the top, they'd heap them up. And then they'd come over and shift there down below where we lived. They call it Washington Hollow. And all of them had Frog Hollow, Washington Hollow, Huffman Hollow. That's what they were, hollows. They had two ball grounds, the Huffman ball ground and the Necker ball ground. But anyway, to get our coal, we had a sled, and we'd get our feed sacks, and all of us, not just us, but everybody go down there, and then coal cars, that train would hit them coal cars when they was parking them, getting them ready to go back to Cumberland, and all that coal would roll down, and big lumps would come down off the side, and all you could see was people there loading their sack up. Remember now, this was a depression. We had nobody had much. Unless you was a moonshiner or something, then you might have been. There was a few well-to-do, so to speak, up there. But she raised us, and some of the neighbors would give us milk and helped us through, had a cow. And
how about your grandparents? Were they nearby?
Grandparents, they lived up on the Huffman Hollow Road, and it was odd. They had nothing. My grandpap, he worked in number 5 mine that was over the hill from him, and he must have got tuberculosis. And the rest of the family, my mother's sisters, my brother-in-law, she had 2 sisters and my grandpap. My grandma had died somewhere back in, we'll say, the early 30s or late 20s. But he was an old-timer, and he died of dropsy, but they had nothing either. I don't know how they survived. Mom would take us up after my dad died. We'd walk up there a bit, pretty good hill, but just to get us out of the house, she'd take us up there. And her sister got electrocuted. Lightning hit her sister out by the cistern. They had a cistern. And she was out there swinging on her first communion day. And a storm come up, and lightning hit her and killed her. That would have been another sister of hers. So she had about 4 sisters, and minus my sister, my aunt, and my brother and my uncle, he never worked. He wouldn't work. He was had a beautiful voice. He just took singing up. He could have been a singer, beautiful singer, but he never done nothing. I don't know how they live. I really don't.
Your mother's brother.
My mother's brother-in-law wouldn't work. My mother's brother, she had one brother, and he was an electrician. They put him through school, and he got to be a pretty well electrician up there, private business. But I don't think he ever helped him, and he never helped my mother. He never came down.
Would you characterize your family as close-knit or not so close-knit, your extended family?
Well, my mother, or my father, like I say, his brother got killed, Eddie. He never saw Steve. I only saw Uncle Steve. He came in for a day when he was laid out. I don't know how they got in touch with him. My Uncle Harry never come back from Arkansas to see my dad. So they was not close. You know, they didn't communicate that I know of. If they did, I never knew it. But I never heard him talking much about it. He'd talk about his brothers, but it was never anything that set my mind. You know.
How about your mother's family?
Mother's family, like I say, she was a telephone operator when her and my dad got married. She worked for C&P, and she had to walk to work about 3 or 4 miles every day up off that hill and back in the winter and the summer. So it was pretty tough. But then when they got married, Dad took over, I guess, and she got that flu, and she wasn't much good. But she would do what she could for her dad, which, again, would take some potatoes up out of the garden, and we'd share what we had, you know.
Did your mother ever talk about Franklin Roosevelt as president during the 30s?
Oh, yeah. She liked Franklin Roosevelt. We liked Franklin Roosevelt. She talked. Everybody talked about Franklin Roosevelt.
Did you have a radio in your home?
Yeah. And we remember Pearl Harbor. We couldn't get very good because the ground wasn't too good. We didn't have no rod down there, but we listened to Amos and Andy and James Arnett or the Gunsmoke, whoever played Gunsmoke, you know. Amos and Andy and all them little shows that was on, Fibber McGee and Molly. We'd sit around the radio at night, and we had a big coal burner, and my mother fired it up. And she'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and get us out to school, and she'd fire up that coal stove and always had it warm for us. Cook chicken, we had chicken, she'd kill the chickens and make noodles and bake bread. She worked hard so much. If I had her back today, I guess I could do so much for her, but all of us. But then we went in the service.
Tell me about what you knew what was going on in the world with Adolf Hitler and the Japs before Pearl Harbor.
Okay. I remember the Hindenburg. I remember him on the radio saying the Hindenburg come down, and then we'd go to a show sometimes, and they'd have that home news, you know, whatever, and it was only maybe a nickel or something to go to the show, and how we managed was, like I say, I worked at a grocery store, and they didn't give me much money, but they gave me meat and that to take home in the evening after school. The school was right across from the grocery store, so I would go on the delivery truck and work there for 5 years, delivering with this guy.
Before the war.
So I got to know pretty much what was going on, you know. Pat Burns, he was my boss, and I, like I say, was only 12, I guess, working, carrying orders in the evening and on Saturdays. And I made some money, and my brother would go out and they'd dig basements or something. Joe, that was a brother in Philadelphia. Little Paul, he didn't. He was too young then to work, you know. He was only like 8 or 9 or something. He was growing up. But the three of us worked. My sister, she'd do what she could and help.
Tell me about your school. Was there anything that stuck out in your mind about your schooling?
Oh, yeah. I liked school. And we went to the Catholic school. We had 6 grades. That mile and a half up over the hill. We'd walk to school, whether the snow was up to our knees, up to our butt or whatever. You went to school. You didn't get no snow day. And we walked up over the hill, the four of us, in the morning. We all went to the Catholic school. And my brother then went on to high school at Bell.
Who was your favorite teacher?
Well, it would have been, had to be a sister. They were nuns. They taught us. And Sister Paula, I guess if I can remember names, she stood out. And they were good to us, you know. We were poor, but they was good to us, and we was dressed nice. I would say Sister Paula was my best teacher and nun. But they was all good, and I mean strict, but good.
What subject did you like the best?
Well, it seemed like I liked history. I didn't mind math. I wasn't as good at math as I was geography and history. I would say that. And religion, you got to remember, they had the catechism, and you learned that at Catholic school. You learned to be a Catholic, and it was good.
During the later part of the Great Depression, the country kept going up and down, up and down.
Right.
A lot of programs were brought in by Franklin Roosevelt, the Triple C's. And
the NYA, WPA.
Did you get involved with any of those programs?
No, my brother, John, he got on. That's where he quit high school, to make some money. And he went to work for the NYA.
What did he do?
Well, he went out and built, they built walls. The WPA built these big walls. And I think he worked for the NYA, but I'm not sure. He might have worked for the WPA.
Did he go and didn't come back for long periods of time?
Oh, no, that was local. He got to be around wherever they worked at, you know, maybe up in Frostburg on the wall or something. I don't remember him ever going away. Now, the CC camps was in force at the time.
Tell me about what you saw with the CCC camps.
CCC camp? Well, I knew that they had them, and I guess my brother would have joined them, but he had so much to do at home, he wanted to stay. He wanted to work, and he worked hard on the WPA, and he helped it with the kids. And, but he never went to the CC camp. The CC camps I knew very little about, only to hear people talk that they went away and they got a dollar a day or something, I think.
So they didn't come marching through town at any time?
No, not that I know. The CC camps we had was, one was out on Green Ridge, where you were like, over to where we end up in Williamsburg. They had a big one out there. And they had one up outside of Coney. There are two that I can remember that a lot of people went to, a lot of the guys.
Tell me how race relations was in your community, black people and white people.
We didn't have no black people, only one. Dusty Rhodes was in Eckerd. He must have weighed 300 and some pounds. He was a black fella. He lived by himself in a hut over in Beer Alley. Never bothered nobody. Dusty Waits was his name. He worked hard, and he never bothered nobody.
You mentioned that Eckerd Mines was a company-owned town.
Right.
Did the company have their own police force, and were they
were they
bad to the workers, in your opinion?
They weren't. The Jenkins brothers was millionaire. And the Consolidated Coal Company was the one that had all the mines in Frostburg and Eckerd, and they controlled the whole thing, Lona County, the whole mining area. And they would build the houses and put you in, and you paid at the company store. But there wasn't much work, you know. If the whistle blowed three times, you didn't go to work the next day. They'd blow the whistle 3 o'clock every day. They had no police force. There was no police force. It was just a town that kind of had a sheriff and a constable. And then you had Walter, what's his name? I started to tell you about the coal operator. He was the inspector for the coal company, the railroad. And everybody was afraid of him. You had to watch out for him when they throwed that coal off, and he was packing her up. But I'm sure he knew that they were taking it. And I don't remember anybody ever getting arrested for hauling it up their house. And my brother Joe and I'd haul maybe 2 sacks up a night, and we'd store it up. And then we had a coal bank outside of our home. We'd go up there and dig in the coal bank and get the coal for the winter.
Did the company ever evict people that you saw?
They was never bad to us that I can remember. I think they respected my mother, and they knew my dad died in the mine. And I don't remember him ever pushing or even mentioning anything about eviction. If she needed something done, they'd send a guy over by the name of Lepley. He was a maintenance man, and he'd fix it. Then they'd come around and clean the toilets out they had. So they done pretty good. And when we went to service, we all signed up to give her mother our... I never knew what a $20 bill was. Not even till I come back in 45, I wouldn't have known what a $20 bill was. But we went in there, and I signed my mother allotment. My brother Joe signed the allotment, and my brother John. So we'd send it home, but we'd tell her to get what she wanted, to buy the house. And so she'd have the house, you know, but she never did. She saved the money, like she saved everything. And,
as World War II kept going, before we got involved, before Pearl Harbor, you're still a kid, had you ever seen any Jewish people in your neighborhood?
No Jewish people.
No Jewish?
Not that I knew of. No Jewish people.
Had you heard about the things that Hitler was doing beforehand?
Now, Frostburg and Lonicone had a lot of Jewish people. They had stores, and you would hear, I would just hear conversations. I didn't know. My wife was from Coney, and she'd come up to Eckerd, and that's where I met her. And we went together. We was only 14, 13 or something, but that's where we met. But in Coney, there was a lot of Jewish stores. And down the creek, I would say, Coney was the worst of them. They all migrated into Coney, and that was a big coal mining. I mean, people was there on the street every night piled up, and it was a big, prosperous little coal mine company. But I never caught a Jewish. Frostburg had blacks. They were good blacks. I could say today I'd go up and play with them. My aunts lived up there, and I'd play with them. We'd go down to the ballpark, and they could never go in the swimming pool. They was restricted, but they was poor church mice.
In December 1941, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
Right.
Where did you hear the news? What were you doing?
We were eating lunch when we had the radio on. Mom always kept it on, like Sunday, you could hear pretty good. And I can remember this. I'd brought home a round steak from the store they gave me Saturday. And she'd dice it up, and she'd put potatoes in it. And then that big iron skillet, she'd make a meat pie. About that thick, and about that big around. And we were having meat pie that afternoon. And I can remember that. And they said Pearl Harbor was attacked. And then we all went in and gathered around the radio. And my brother John, I guess he would have been about 15 then. 12 went to 33. What would we say? He was getting close to draft age, because he was first drafted in 42. And sent over to North Africa, done the whole war, and went over to France.
You were still young. Did you know what a Jap was?
A Japanese? I didn't have much use for them when they was killing our boys over in Pearl Harbor. I don't think I ever took a stand at that time. But as time progressed, and I got into my 16 years, then I built up a resentment. Not that I just wanted to get in there and do something.
The war had been going on for about a year and a quarter or so before you enlisted.
Yeah.
Did you, as a kid, do anything here in your hometown to help with the war effort?
No. The only thing I did was try to help my mother. Worked at the store after school and on Saturdays. And sometimes on Sunday I had to go in and help clean up the store.
You didn't do any scrap driving?
Oh, what we would do, we'd go out, yeah, since you mentioned it, I never give it much thought, because we would go out and try to find some iron and scrap, and there was a big scrap Jewish fellow up in Frostburg, Aberson or something, and he collected the scrap, and he sold it all through the Depression and everything. That's what they throwed back at us when they attacked us, you know. We were sending all our iron and steel over there, and they was making guns. Because when I went to Baltimore on the bus to enlist, to get sworn in, they had these Air Force wardens up on them water tanks, and they had guns, looked like guns. And the guy said, I said, they'd shoot you. He said, they can't shoot you, they're only wooden guns. That's all they had. They didn't have no guns. We didn't have no guns. I can remember that. But we did go out and get aluminum cans and collect iron, whatever we could find, and we'd take it up and get a few bucks. I remember that now. But it wasn't. It was rare.
How about meat collection or rationing?
Rationing. We was rationed. But again, if I can remember, I don't think we got any canned goods then. I think maybe we'd have to go over in Akron and get them from the store, and you'd get beef, canned beef, and I guess vegetables. I don't remember that.
During the war, they collected fats, and usually that was done through a butcher shop. Did your store that you worked at collect fats that were then...
Yeah, I think I remember putting that in big barrels. He'd take that fat off of there, John. He was a meat cutter. There was about five brothers was in the store, and they was all bachelors, and they all had their job to do. One was a cash register. Pat, his name was Leo. I was with him all the time. I'd go out and deliver the orders, and they had these metal cans that you'd pack the orders up. And they'd done well, you know, but they let people put people on the bill, and a lot of people beat them out of money. They never made nothing in the general store, but they were good to the people. You know, they didn't press anybody to take you to jail. But sometimes when you'd run the bill up to $100 or something, they kind of put a stop on it until you made some restitution. But that is about what I did. And I brought that steak home that night, that Saturday night. There's two things stands out in my mind, that steak and my mother diced it and made the meat pie for Pearl Harbor. And my grandpa was dying with dropsy. And I went over to the store and helped clean up. And they said, how's your grandfather, Bernie? I said, I don't know. I said, I don't think he's so well. So they said, what do you want to take him? I said, well, he likes, what was that kind of milk you got?
Buttermilk?
Buttermilk, yeah. I said, he likes buttermilk. And they gave me a cake for him and half a gallon of buttermilk. And I walked over past the two ball grounds. If you go up through Eckerd, Quest is there now, a big plant. And you went by the Eckerd ball ground, then you went over to Huffman. That's where my grandpap lived back in there. And I just got there, and my mother was crying, and I was too late with the buttermilk. He never got the buttermilk, but it stood out in my mind. He had a big beard, huh?
The war starts, and you say your older brother got drafted?
My oldest brother got drafted, and he went to Fort Knox in 42. I would say it was midsummer. He didn't stay down there. He got trained. He was on the big toms and big gun. And he had some buddies from Frostburg that went with him, was drafted. And they all went through the war together over in North Africa.
Did he ever come home before you left to go to
the Navy? One time. And it wasn't very long. He only had about 4 days. And he come home in his uniform.
How did he look to you as a younger kid?
Oh, he just looked like a hero to me. And I said to myself, if I get of age, that was when I first said, I'm not going to let him over there by himself. And then my brother, Joe, he got drafted. And like I say, when he got drafted like this week. And I got enlisted and I changed my birth certificate. My mother didn't know it. I just made a change and I said, I'm going. So they put all them draftees on the bus. And I said, I want to get on that bus and go to Baltimore. So I got on the bus with the draftees and went down, and the recruiting officer, he processed me and he said, I had them eye teeth. I had some bad teeth, eye teeth, you know, coming down like a dragon, Dracula, you know. And that always bothered me. And I only weighed about 118.
How old were you at that time?
16.
Really 16?
16. Really 16.
But they thought you were 17.
Well, I had her on there 60, and they didn't bother because you had guys like Tommy Dunn and Davis and a whole bunch went in when they was 15. I knew guys here in the service that went in when they was 15. But they didn't care. You know, they might have cared, but they didn't. They wasn't going to turn you away. You know?
So you went down to Baltimore on a bus for draftees.
With the draftees.
Your brother was there, wasn't he?
My brother was in there.
And he didn't rat out on you about how old you were?
Oh, no. He never said anything. He figured if I was going to do it, I was going to do it, you know. We never ratted on each other no time. Anytime we was growing up, we was close. We was close brothers.
What happened in Baltimore?
Well, Baltimore, I went to the recruiting, and they was processed down there, the draftees, but the bus stayed there, so they held them over. And this recruiting officer said, Mr. Cordial, if you want to go home, you can go home and you'll never have to go in the Navy. You'll never have to go in the service. You got bad teeth, and you're underweight. I said, I want to go. I don't want to go home. He said, I want to go. My brother's on that bus. I want to go with him. So they worked it out. They gave me two big steaks and tried to get my weight up. They got my weight up then. And the next day, they held the bus over. I don't know why, whether they had influence or what, but they held the bus till the next day. And they got my weight up, and they said they was going to fix my teeth. And on the bus I got, and then we get on the train, and we went to Great Lakes.
Had you ever been that far from home before?
Never. Never any farther than, I don't think I was only in Cumberland once. That was about 14 miles from Eckert to Cumberland, I'd say on the old 40. You got to come and you had to walk or take a bus or something.
So tell me, when you got off the bus or train at Great Lakes, Illinois, what was your first thought?
The first thought was I was happy. I was just happy. I was with my brother and they put us in formation and they took us down and they got our clothes. And they took us, walked us down to the company barrack. This Commander McGaffney, he was a first class. Normally it was a chief that was your commanding officer, but he was good first class, so they made him the commander. And this you won't believe, I was rattling on like a kid would rattle on to his brother. And the first thing he said was, there'll be no talking, discussions of any kind. We got our sea bags. We had our sea bags on our shoulder with our pea coats and our uniform, and we marched 2 miles down to that barrier. Well, I was talking to my brother, and he dropped back, that commander. He said, "Remember, I told you, your ass belongs to us. Your heart belongs to your mother, but your ass belongs to us." He said, "I told you not to talk." So he stuck the hat in my mouth, my hat, took my cap. Now that was when I learned, right then and there, I was a man. I jumped from a boy to a man because I know they meant business, you know. And they had fences out there. And when he got you down there, he said, "If you're thinking about going over them fences and get homesick," he said, "we've had boys go over that fence," and he said, "they thought they were spies and they shot them." I mean, that might have been for a little frightening part, you know, but he convinced me. I never gave it a thought. I never gave it a thought about going AWOL. And my brother and I, just to show you how poor we were, we had this company, and we was, in the evening, we'd go up to the ship store. We didn't have no money, neither one of us. I don't think we had a dollar between us in boot camp. We got our meals, we had a clean bed, and we'd been happy. We were home, we know what home was, and we was together. We slept up above each other. But to get home for leave, we had to figure out how to get some money. You know, we didn't know whether it was going to be there 4 weeks or 6 weeks. So every night, we'd get one of them milk cartons. These guys that had money, we'd have to walk up to ship store about a mile and a half. And he and I'd take this milk carton, and we'd go up there. When we took our buck or 2 bucks, what we had, and we invested it in some candy bars and some little half a pint of milk. And the first night we took, I think, 10 of each down, and we sold them. We might have paid a nickel for them, I don't know, but we sold them. They didn't care if they had to pay 15 cents. Well, we started selling in the evening, and it got better and got better. So at the end of, when we were home in 4 weeks, the Red Cross wouldn't give us, my mother, no money to bring us home. I never had no use for the Red Cross, because they'd charge you for donuts and the coffee, and they'd charge you everything. They charged Salvation Army, wasn't like that. They'd give us something, donuts and everything. But the Red Cross didn't help my mother, but we managed to raise, I guess, enough for a train fare home. And of course, when we got home after our leave was only about 7 days, then we went back to Washington on the train. Now they paid for that, because that's on your schedule there, will show you. We disembarked from Washington, D.C., and we went to San Francisco. Right back through Cumberland on the train, we went to Washington, got on that train, and we come through Cumberland, and it only stopped for about 10 minutes there. So you didn't get off, or you didn't do anything.
At boot camp, was it difficult for you?
No.
You were physically fit?
I got to tell you, it was not difficult. I guess maybe my brother was there and I was happy to be with him. And that's what I wanted. And we did get to stay together. We went to New Caledonia. And like I say, we raised some money together, and we were close, you know. And he'd go up there on Saturdays. They'd pull my teeth. And they pulled teeth. And they'd... He'd get these big towels and get some water on them. And we had the afternoon off on Saturday afternoon, so we could go up and watch them play ball at the ball field. And he'd take me up, and we put that towel on there and stopped the bleeding. And these were things that they weren't what bad things. They were good things. You know, here, I'm getting my teeth fixed. My mother's getting some money. We're eating. You know? And I'm a man. I'm becoming a man because I'm in with men. The oldest guy in our company was Ralph Racing. He just died at 97. And he was about 37 then. He was a banker's son. And that's what I say, these people, some of them had a lot of money. And they didn't mind paying us in the evening. I guess maybe they respected what we did, you know, work for it. But
how long did you stay in San Francisco before you went overseas?
Okay. Then we went to San Francisco. We was there long enough to check her bag, get checked in, and get on board a ship.
Did you know you were going into PT boats at this time?
No, you didn't know. I didn't know San Diego from nothing, you know. We was in San Francisco, I knew that. And we were going down to San Diego and pick up more troops. The Clip Fontaine was the ship's name. It was a transport, and it hauled about, maybe I'm exaggerating, but I don't know what a troop transport had, but I'd say 10,000 guys on there. They had bunks,
big.
Huh?
They were big.
Big. Matter of fact, we went down, my brother gets sick. Oh, he got seasick. Honest to God, he gets sick. And you know, the good Lord must have been with me because I didn't get no seasick, and I could take care of him. And I did. I watched and made sure he got the throw up over the side. And he finally worked out of it. I'd get him some toast or a piece of bread or something, and took care of him between San Francisco and San Diego. And it was choppy that night going down there. It was really bad. A lot of guys were seasick so bad. But we got to San Diego and we picked up, I don't know how many more, but we had our bunks. There was six high down in the down in the basement, down in the bottom deck. And man, they was all the way from one end of that ship to the other. And they'd bake that bread and they'd take it down through the 6 feet high bunks, you know, you had a foot or something to get in them, but that time I wasn't like that. I was just a little skinny. And then my brother, he wasn't fat. But they bring this bread down, right? And big hands, big blows of bread. And they knew that they wasn't gonna make it. Everybody reached down, get a loaf of bread, about every other bunk or so. And you shared it, you know, you break it in half. You're pretty hungry. And you got fed on the ship, but that was funny. And I'd managed to get him a piece of bread, you know, off of there. And I'd stick a couple pieces in my pocket and take it up and make sure he got it. So he got pretty good. But then we got to New Caledonia. Like I told you, it took us 19 days to get there. And they say that sub waited outside, and the Clip Fontaine was going up to Guadalcanal. Now, we were in New Caledonia.
You didn't go to Pearl Harbor, then?
Huh? No, we didn't go to Pearl Harbor.
So straight to New Caledonia.
He wouldn't stop there. He weaved in and out so he wouldn't torpedo us. You know. And he got us to New Caledonia. And disembarked. We all disembarked there, and we was going to get our assignments where we was going. And that's why we stayed there 2 or 3 days. But they say that sub waited for that ship to come out of New Caledonia, and they torpedoed it. It never got to Guadalcanal. It was going up to Guadalcanal to bring the wounded back. take some back to the States, I guess, and take them to the field hospitals where they were at.
So you missed being torpedoed then?
Well, that's what I say. 2 days out and they torpedoed their three, and here we was on New Caledonia.
How was the insects?
Huh?
How were the insects on New Caledonia?
Insects? Well, you had New Caledonia. We didn't get out of the base too much. Like I say, they had those French cat houses, and you could see them, but you could never get near them, you know. And who'd want to, anyhow? I wouldn't. But anyway, they had the leper colony that was up on the hill, a big leper colony. And you know, you realize that, and they had a hospital there. They had a field hospital at New Hebrides, at New Caledonia. Big one. So I guess maybe they'd bring them down from Bougainville, Guadalcanal, and Tulagi and that, and there, I don't know. In between, they may have had one at New Hebrides that was in between New Caledonia and Guadalcanal, Tulagi. But insects, I imagine they had skeeters in that there. But
you don't remember.
We weren't there long enough. Now when we get up to Tulagi, and we get up to Guadalcanal where it was wet and raining all the time, you had land crabs. You had to put a net up on your bunk. Because you had, in the morning, you get up these land crabs and crawl up the net so they wouldn't bite you. They had different things that come from the ocean, I guess, up on it. The coral reefs was the worst. They would cut you to pieces. It was so sharp, you know, the coral. The island was set up on the Tulagi. It was on the coral reef, you might say. And we had our ship bay, a medical hospital there, and that was the center priest that would say in that paper there, give you the information on how Tulagi took care of the wounded coming in from different ships or ships that was hit. And that's where I was a pharmacist mate then.
So you actually worked in a hospital on land?
Yeah.
But
I was assigned. In other words, if they needed somebody to go on the PT boats, it wasn't often, but they'd say they needed a pharmacist mate, and they was going to make a run that night. And basically, I guess what she was they tried to teach me to shoot them twin 50s, and they'd throw a 50-gallon tank barrel out there, oil barrel. And you think that would be simple, you know, to squeeze off to and shoot that barrel. And I don't think I ever sunk one yet. Then they go up and they go down, you know. But your job was to man that if the gunners may get killed or the torpedo men get killed or anybody get killed.
How many people were on the PT boats?
I think usually 10, 11. You had your gunner's mates, your torpedo men, your mechanic, your executive officer, the skipper. Around, it varied, I think. Yeah, it seemed to me like it was about 9 or 10.
Which one did you, I don't want to say like, but get along with the most? Which boat?
Well, I didn't have no favorites. Like, here's another example. You go back and I told you about my first experience with, I guess he was homosexual. He was up there under my blanket about 2 o'clock in the morning playing with my privates and woke me up and scared the hell out of him. I didn't know assholes mattered. I didn't know, only know the boy and the girl. I didn't know that when we was growing up. I know the girl and the boy. I do know that. But what I didn't know was that there was people like that. Now this guy, when he done that, I said, I was a pretty tough kid when I was growing up because you had to be tough, you know. I wasn't mean or smart or anything, but I sort of had, I guess, leader qualities, because all the guys I run with would say, hey, Bernie, what are we going to do today? What are we going to do? And that gave me a feeling of being a leader. But I could get mean, and I said, you know, you get the hell out of here. That was the only thing I could think of, get mad. And he took off out of that tent. And I didn't have no way of knowing what he looked like. I can remember he was tall.
Was this at Tulagi?
Tulagi, yeah. That was only right after I got there. That I don't think we were settled down about 2 days. The two things I remember about Tulagi, getting there, was when you went into Tulagi, you had this big platform going out into the Coral Sea. And that's where you went to the bathroom, out over, hooped out there and everything, you know. We had the bathrooms out there. And I was amazed, you know. It was okay, but I just never seen anything. I'd seen outdoor toilets, but out over the Coral Sea about, I'd say maybe a mile. They had the poles in, you know, and you'd go out there and poop. And then the fish would eat it, I guess. Yeah. But again, that was my first impression. And the second impression was when I got in that bunk at night and went to sleep, I was awful tired, didn't know. But when he come up under there, I never went to sleep the rest of the night. I laid there and I said, now, you asked me if I knew anybody. I wouldn't have known who the guy next door was.
Where had your brother gone?
In the bunk. This was in a tent.
Where was your brother then?
My brother, he had gone. New Caledonia. We had bought it down in New Caledonia. That was, well, it took us a while to get up to Tulagi. And then I got assigned to PT boats. And where he went, I don't know. He never said. And I think he was a gunner's mate somewhere. I don't think he got to be a third class. He was in gunnery.
Tell me about one of the patrols your PT boat went on.
Well, I can remember the first time. I'll tell you this, and then I can tell you about going out on the first run. I was a farmer's mate. I was going to be a farmer's mate, and they determined that. I was going to go from seaman to a hospital apprentice. Okay? A hospital apprentice was the same as a seaman, only he was going to be a farmer's mate. You're going to be a medic. And you had to go through a course. It was just like learning to be a nurse. It was basically what you had to do, because you ended up making medicine, you ended up fixing pills, you ended up giving shots, and the whole 9 yards, you know. Somebody got their arm shot up or something, you had to put a band. And it was all part of the game. But the first time they called us out was one night I had to go down to the pharmacist mate. They called. I don't know how they got us. But we went down. And this today's working on. We went up to the guy laying there on the dock. And he had this .45. And he had blowed his brains out. Homesick. You know, a lot of them did it. Got homesick. Couldn't take it. He was an ensign. He just blowed his brains out, I guess, you know, because there he was laying there. And the pharmacist mate, of course, he was in charge, and he looked at him, and there was no question about him. He was dead. But it was a terrible sight for a 16-year-old boy to see. 3 days later, a homosexual. Now, I'm not totally prepared for anything, so these was two things that got in my mind right then and there that didn't make me feel too good. during the night, I thought, who can I talk to when that homosexual? And I'm assuming that's what he was, because he wouldn't have been a fool with me. I don't think if he didn't have some knowledge of what he was doing. And I'm not putting anything down or saying, but I know 2 years later they got him up there. I went to the chaplain. I said, I'm going to the chaplain. That's all I can trust. I don't know anybody else to tell this to. And I went to the chaplain the next morning, and I guess he could understand I was a little upset. And I told him in detail what happened, and he said, did you see him? I said, well, no. I said, when I told him to get out of there, I said, he took off before he woke them other guys up. I don't know whether he did or not wake them up, but I said it loud enough, and I'm sure some of them might have, but he took off out of the tent. And I don't know how many the tent held. I'm going to say 12. I'm not just assuming that. But that was our quarters. Then they said one time, Cordial, you go out tonight. They're going to make a run. Now, this is the first I'd ever been. This was maybe, I don't know whether it was, we'll say 3 weeks to a month later. And they let me get familiar a little bit. Yeah, I can remember that. But I went out, and like I say, that seasickness comes back now. You don't. What helped me was I never get seasick. I went on that boat. We went up and we patrolled the island. Nothing happened that night. We didn't run into no barges. And we sailed back into the loggy the next morning before daybreak. So you get back under camouflage. The last thing you want to be was out in that coral sea in the daylight. Because then Jap planes or whatever, they'd shoot you right from the beach. You know.
Did you see Japanese airplanes flying down the Solomon Chain?
The first one was on Guadalcanal, and this is another thing that gets me today, and I still remember, is this kamikaze come in. Now, whether he was a kamikaze into the loggy, and I could see him coming over the zero, and we all looked out, and he come in, and whether he was hit, shot, or I don't know, but he did come down and crash. And some of them Marines run up there and jumped up on the plane and drug him out of there. And I couldn't see the whole detail, but I don't know whether they cut his ears off, cut his tongue out, and you know, I don't know, but I just, it looked to me like they was kind of trying to get a piece of him. And the scarf he had on fell off into the jungle there. And I did pick that up. I had no intention of keeping it. I didn't know what to do with it, so I just stuck it in my pocket and took it down to the base. And what happened to him after that, I don't know. But I do know they drug him out of there. And I do know that they done some things, or I don't think atrocities that might have. We talk about being brutal. They was just as mad at them Japanese as they could be.
Did you go out on any combat patrols where you saw the enemy?
I never had a chance to go. A couple times we went out and they fired torpedoes. I didn't know where they was at, and I didn't know what boat we were on. It didn't matter. I didn't care about a boat. But what I did go was a couple times they assigned me to some Marine cleanup skirmishes. They were still Japanese on there, like, you know, Guadalcanal, you cleaned her up and they won the war in 42 to 43, but inside of 43, you still had, in them islands, you had them Japanese on there, and they had them barges. I mean, them barges is big. they could haul 400 to 500 of them Japanese soldiers and move them from one island to the other. And they kept them poor old people over in Tulagi moving all the time. You know. That's where we got our radio men that from, was them natives. And we had to later take care of them when they'd come down there on Saturdays, and we'd give them sheets to put over their breasts. We'd do anything to help them. They'd take the sheets and come back maybe the next Saturday. I don't know. I told the wife, I said that. But getting back to your question, I had some activity, but my work was at the hospital most of the time, and I could be assigned to the Marine, and I was assigned on some skirmishes. And sometimes I had to patch them up and get them back, you know.
Can you describe one patient that you remember vividly?
Well, the first ones, I guess, would be the belly wounds that you couldn't do anything about. And again, I was only a hospital apprentice at the time. I wasn't too familiar. I was growing into it, like from the guy blowing his brains out, I was getting that in my mind. And anything else that come after that, if it was a cut arm or something, I could put a bandage on it. If it was shrapnel or something, he was bleeding bad, I could put pressure on it. And things like that, head injuries, you had to have a first class or something. He knew what he was doing. You know. But I grew into it. And then I was assigned to the base most of the time.
At Tulagi.
At Tulagi, in a hospital. And we had a wonderful doctor. He was from Chicago. His name was Bird, I believe, Bird. He taught me so much. He took me under his wing, so to speak. And we had 120 proof alcohol. And he taught me how to mix cough medicine with it, and what grams to use, and the milligram part. And you had to cram this, you know. After you got learning that, you didn't have too much time to. But if it was needed, you went. But the big highlights of my life over there was they did bring bad people in, wounded people in, and they was hurt bad. When I got on that plane, I told you earlier, it's C-47, flying boxcar, they call it. And like I say, they did have planes there that could shoot you down. Japanese managed to have a plane once in a while make its way down there. But when he told me I was going to fly that up there, it didn't have no doors on it, and I mean, I didn't give them no gab, you know. I went, but after I got on there, I was okay. It was just like anything, you know. You just satisfied yourself that was a way to get up to Bougainville in the quick way. And we got the medicine up there and brought it back. We had to get medical supplies, and that's what we went up for.
And your job on that trip was to do what?
To get the medical supplies and bring them back. We had a pharmacist made first with me, and we ordered the supplies, and we got them, and we brought them back to Guadalcanal, because there's still wounded people there.
Were we talking about tons of it, or just
pretty big loads, you know. They had the supplies. I guess the ship come in there with the medical supplies, and that's where they were short down on Guadalcanal. This is what I'm assuming. That we was just out of supplies, because he said, get your ass up there and get these supplies. And you learned right then and there that we went up there and loaded them up and back and unloaded them there. And I guess over in Tulagi, we took most of them over there. And they got some there on Guadalcanal.
Did you have any Japanese patients that you worked on?
I seen two come in, and one of them, he was shot up pretty bad. And I don't know what happened, where it happened. The other one wasn't too bad, and they got him out of there. But the one that was shot up pretty bad, he died. It looked like he was hit. Looked like he might have been hit with some of her own firewire.
Did you find any patients whose feet were rotting off?
Yeah, I seen the rot there. You had to get that salve and put on them. They call that foot rot. And you can understand why you got it, because I got some of it. It was damp, raining all the time. It rained about every day. Showers would come, and then it would get terribly hot. It was always like 110. I mean, if that shower come, then it really got hot and humid, you know. And like I said, there was nothing but coral there, bad coral, and that would cut you like a razor. You had a lot of people in that sick bay that had bad cuts, just like a razor blade. I know, because you had to get new shoes every month, and marine shoes, big soles on them. You'd step on that coral, and they'd cut them. But getting back to your question, rot. Yeah, I took care of that.
Any people in your hospital that came that had no physical injuries but was touched with problems?
Yeah, it was all kind come in. They was ones that, like the guy that shot himself, only they was working on it. You know, it was working on them. And some of them couldn't stay, I guess. Doctor would have to evaluate him and either send him to the field hospital, but he made a determination there. Like, and it worked on him. I seen him. You know, they'd get shaken and nervous, and they were homesick. And, it was sad.
When the war in Europe ended in May of 1945, you were way off in Nowheresville, South Pacific somewhere. The war was not over for you.
No. We still went through the regular. We still had a war going on. We still had people coming in. We had to take care of people in sick bay. And then in July, they told us to back up. They was going to send us to Australia when we had a year in, for R&R time. We heard rumors of it. And some of them guys had went down there. We took them down to Australia and gave them a week or two. I don't know what it was. But they told us we was going to do it. But in July of 45, they said, pack up, you're going home.
Did you have enough points to go home?
Huh?
Did you have points?
Oh, yeah. We was over there 2 years. We had enough points. There was a bunch of us. And then we went over to Guadalcanal and loaded on the boat. Come back on the boat.
What's the name of the boat? You
I can't remember. The Clipfontaine we went over on, but you know, the Clipfontaine was a Dutch ship. And the American ship, I don't know what that was. I often try to think about it, and I have nightmares sometimes. The VA knows that. A lot of times I can't remember things.
But you came into San Francisco again?
Huh?
Did you come back to San Francisco?
Yeah, we come back. I don't know how long it took us to get back, but I think we come back less days than it took us to Woolworth, maybe 10 days or something. But this is in July, see. So the war's concentrated up in Iwo Jima, Okinawa.
Where were you when you heard the news of the atomic blast?
Well, this is what I'm going to tell you. We come back in July, and we come home on leave. We've got to go out on Liberty in San Francisco for about two nights, but when we pulled in, when we docked that night, they had this big, oh man, this big huge mess hall. And they lined us up. And the first thing they did was take us to this mess hall. I gotta remember, it's been 2 years since, I guess, I'm not saying we didn't have some meat, but most of the time it was mutton or spam or sea rations or a lot of mixed stuff. But you had a, you know, you had a galley and everything, and they fixed your lunch. But if you have a room there too. They took us into that mess hall, and they set a big steak down, and we hadn't had any fresh milk. I can't remember having fresh milk, powdered milk. And they set that pitcher of milk, and man, that was just like heaven. I'm telling you, that steak just, I never tasted anything so good in my life. And neither did the rest of them. I don't know if it was tough or not, but it was delicious. You know? And that milk was just so good, and you could have all you wanted. And it was good to be home.
But you weren't home yet. You were
always
in San
Francisco, but it was good to be in the United States. It was good to be back home. I have no regrets about the 2 years. I left no regrets. I have none. But what we did then, we spent about a week or two, and that's where I got that picture of that tailor-made uniform. We all got a tailor-made uniform, and I'm glad we did. But then we got on the train, and we come into Washington. And then I come into Cumberland. Or did I get off? I get off in Cumberland because I didn't go to Washington, but I saved my ticket because I had a report to Washington when my leave was up. So when I got off that train there in Cumberland, I almost kissed the ground. It was just like I was on a cloud when we got off that big Queen City station. That big train left us off. And you stepped down on there, it was just like heaven, like he was on a cloud. And I didn't kiss the ground, but I would have, and I should have. But it was just wonderful. And then we had about, didn't have any more than 7 days. And I didn't have seen her for 2 years, and she was just a little kinky thing when I went over and went in the Navy. And she had graduated from high school. I sent her a graduation gift. And I went down to see her, and she was just the prettiest thing I ever saw.
What's her name?
Ellen. Her name's Sarah Ellen. I call her Sarah Ellen sometimes, but Ellen Lee, they call her mostly. She graduated in 45. And she was, she met me at the door, and she had a beautiful blue dress on, and she was built just like that. That was her, and she was beautiful. I couldn't believe it. So then we stayed it, and for 7 days we went out and had some food and took my mother out. And I got on a train 7 days later. They was in Cumberland, went to Washington. But on a train in Washington, we was there about 4 days, maybe 5 days in Washington. Didn't stay long.
Yeah, this is all before the atomic blast over here.
Yeah. So they sent us back to San Francisco. This would have been the end of July, the 1st of August. 1st of August, okay. They put us in a bullpen out there. Bullpen. A big enclosure. There had to be 5,000 of us in that bullpen, and maybe more. I guess maybe 15,000. And we was in there for 2 days and the ninth, wasn't it? The ninth they dropped it on the first one, and that didn't didn't take that one. And we all wondered whether he was going, because we was going to go to Tokyo. We was getting ready to ship out, and they was bringing troops from over in Europe. They was bringing troops from Europe to go over.
So where were you when you heard the news of the atomic bombs?
Okay. We heard the news in the bullpen. They announced it over the loudspeaker, the second one. They said the war's over. The Japanese is going to surrender. They dropped the second war on a bomb on Hiroshima, and they opened the gates. And we were out of the bullpen. And then we got reassigned. But the way they reassigned us was all odd names. Mine was Cordial and Blight, Vendetti. And they took five pharmacist mates. And they assigned us to Portland, Oregon. And when we went up to Portland, Oregon from there, and they put us at the Kaiser Shipyards. And then they would put us on troop trains. A pharmacist mate would get on a troop train, and you went to different, take these troops that was getting discharged. And that was your job then. You'd ride that troop train, then you'd go back to Portland, Oregon.
All the way across the country sometimes.
Sometimes to Tennessee and up to St. Louis. And that was our job. And but if you needed a doctor, then we was the ones that told the conductor, hey, we got an appendicitis here, or we got somebody that's sick or head injury or something. And he'd call ahead then and stop the train in a city, in a town.
Did you keep a personal diary while you were overseas?
No.
Did you ever consider that you were making history?
No. Oh, never give her a thought. Never. I was just, you know, I wonder sometimes, 2 years seems like a long time, but it just seemed like 2 days. There was so much to do over there and so much to take care of, and I was so proud.
Did you carry any type of good luck charm?
No, my wife sent me a bracelet. Well, she was my girlfriend, and she said, I still got that little metal bracelet. And she said, Love Ellen on it. I got that. I never, medal, I kept the St. Anthony medal with me all the time. My mom and my sisters give me.
Did you make any lasting friends while you were in the military overseas?
Oh, I'd say yeah. I'd say I had a nice personality. And you didn't get acquainted with anybody, because sometimes you'd meet them and they'd move out the next day. There was no way of ever. But what you did work with, like Dr. Bird said, you know, the staff there was really good. You got to know them and like them. And I think I got along fine with them. They got along fine with me. We was just in Dr. Bird. I hate to go when I said I'm going home, but I think he was ready to ship out too back home.
Were there any nurses, female nurses in your?
Yeah, there was nurses there. There was nurses. They were the top dogs there. The nurses. In other words, they was in charge. What there was there, they was nurses. They was like, they tell us what to do, and we do it. Pharmacists make. But again, you had to know what you was doing. And you'd give shots, and they'd have to get a line up and get some shots. And I learned a lot. And even Dr. Bird said, why don't you go to be a doctor? He said, you'd make a good doctor. I said, well, I don't know if I'm smart enough for that.
Did you?
Huh?
Did you ever?
I went to school. I didn't get my diploma there, but I went to Chicago. I left for Chicago. And I went out there and worked. And went to school, different schools at night. And I got my equivalent test out there at school at night. But in Chicago. I stayed there for about 2 years, 3 years, 2.5 years. And I went to some business school. I went to typewriter school. I got my equivalent. But you'd go out in the daytime and you'd get a job. You'd go down in the morning on Michigan Avenue saying, here's a guy standing there. I need so many people to empty a steel car of coal. Or we need somebody to carry bricks. You'll get paid at 4 o'clock. You got my GI. And I got paid every day. And then I could go to school, and I did that at night. And I got my equivalent test, because when I come back here, I had my diploma there to get on at the telephone company. But my home place up in the Hollow, all my military stuff was there, my mother's house. And we got married in 52. And I went to work at the telephone company in 51. We weren't married yet. And I left my ruptured duck and all up home. And some vandals got in it. My mother died in 62. And some vandals got there one night and set it on fire. The house, the home plate. And everything that we had, or all of us had, was gone.
Did your military experience influence your thinking about war or about the military?
Yeah, I still think, I would say, what I try to profess today is they shouldn't have stopped the draft. They should have kept getting these boys, because I learned a valuable experience. If you took a boy out of high school. I worked in American Legion with Boys State. I went and got, you had Boys State down there in Virginia. I was chairman of the Boys State, and it was an honor for me to get the guidance counselor and the principal, and we'd get the good boys out of the junior class and send them down to the Boys State. The Marines run it. And I mean, my son was down there for a week, and when they come back for a week, any one of them will tell you today that was in Boys State that it was the best time of their life. And them Marines was tough. They'd get them up at 5 o'clock in the morning and make them shower and get them better. And I had them come up to me and say, thank you, Mr. Corbin. I've had them come up to me and say they went to Annapolis, they went to West Point, they become fighter pilots. Everyone that I ever sent down there done something. And my theory was, 2 years is not going to hurt anybody. It's basically, I know we've had wars, and I know we'll be at Vietnam. But look at us today, you know. If each boy in this country would have done 2 years away from home in boot camp, now I don't mean to go out there and get killed, but I mean take your chances, you know, and get trained, I think it would have been the best thing in the world. I don't mean you have to get drafted, just do 2 years. And look at the advantage they have. They can go to GI school. They can learn what guns are. They can learn what people are. But today, you got so much dope. I look down here at Martin's, and I see them running around scooting with them baggy pants on. And I know they do. You were in a high school. And they could be learning so much. And I stress every chance I get, I tell them, our two grandsons, they didn't go away. And their dad done 24 years, and I was in the Navy. And today, they said, we should have went in there for 2 years.
Do you have any regrets about your service in the military?
None. No regrets about anything in my life. It's been 80-year bad time. Yes, we had bad time. War times, yeah. War time. bad time. But it was part of living.
Thank you for your interview today. Is there any last words you'd like to leave us with? Imagine you telling my son, who's 12-year-old,
okay,
who considers you a hero, and all the other folks I've talked to as hero. What would you tell him?
We weren't no heroes, but we used our youth to win a war and to save our world, and how much it would mean to get familiarized with the military. You know, learn from your dad, your 12-year-old boy. Find out from him what it means to get some military education. And never be afraid. That's what the big thing is. They said, was you afraid? Well, if I told you, Mr. Gerald, I was afraid, I wasn't afraid, that would have been wrong. But I sat out in the jungle. I went on guard duty in Guadalcanal. This might have been August. And I had a big Marine there. His name was Mo Johnson. Big. And he was out there with me. He said, now you're going to take over here 2 o'clock in the morning. And you could hear the whistling up in the pine trees and the coconut trees and the banana trees. And they were out there. They were out there. And he said, are you afraid? And I said, I think I will be, Mo. But I'm not going to tell you about it. And if I am, I'm not going to. He said, that's good. And that's good. And he went back and told his commander about it. He said, that 16-year-old said he was going to be afraid, but he'd never tell us. And it was true just for a short while. And I said to God, and I still say this, good Lord, I was sitting on that stump, and I had that gun. And if I'd have fired, it probably would have blown me off the stump. And I wouldn't have had a chance, I don't think, to fire it anyhow. If the guy was going to shoot me in the head, he was going to shoot me, you know. But I said, good Lord, I wanted to come here. I have no regrets about coming here. And I'm a little afraid. But if you just stand on my shoulder and help me, I'll just be thankful to you. But if anything has to happen, it's okay. And that's my theory today. I just think that way today.
Thank you very much for your interview today.
I appreciate talking to you.